Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello from Stephen Crittenden. Welcome to the Religion Report. A small but, I suspect, significant protest rally took place today at 9 o'clock this morning, in fact, outside the Saudi Arabian Embassy in Canberra. Australia's Shiite community is normally super low-key, but today it was protesting against persecution of Shiites sponsored by the Wahhabi sect in Saudi Arabia, Iraq and Pakistan. In December last year, 30 Wahhabi scholars called on Sunnis in the Middle East to support the Sunni militias in Iraq. And then one of the most senior Wahhabi clerics in Saudi Arabia, Abdul Rahman al-Barak, released a fatwa describing Shiites as infidels, apostates and hypocrites, more dangerous than Christians and Jews. The Shia are a persecuted minority in Saudi Arabia. And here in Australia, the Shiite community has not been politically active in the past. But today's protest may be the first sign of a much broader looming conflict between Shiites and Sunnis reaching Australia's shores from the Middle East. Akil al-Sharif is a spokesman for the Shiite community, and I asked him why the Saudi Arabian embassy in Canberra had been chosen for this protest rally.
This protest is to condemn the terrorism action in Iraq led by Al-Qaeda terrorist network. Al-Qaeda follows the Wahhabis ideology or belief, and we choose to demonstrate in front of the Saudi Arabia embassy because these Wahhabis leaders, the spiritual leaders, are well respected by the Saudi authority, and they have power in there.
In fact, I think, Akil, in late 2006 and again early this year, leading clerics in Saudi Arabia have issued fatwas against the Shia.
That's right. This is not the first time. This is only renewal for many fatwas.
What is the fatwa directed at Shiites in Saudi Arabia or Iraq or more generally?
It's more generally. It's consider all Shia in the world. They believe that Shia should be killed, whether babies, women, men, and also their interests should be destroyed. Like what's happening now in Iraq and the Shia's areas and cities. They cannot stand or understand and accept that Shia and Iraq are free and they are getting their rights and enjoying democracy. And they should really accept the fact that majority, three-quarter of the Iraqi people are Shia.
Akil, tell me this. How many Shia are there in Australia?
Approximately, there is no exact figures, but I believe they are less than 50,000, less than 60,000, yeah.
And mainly in Sydney and Melbourne?
Mainly Sydney and Melbourne.
Do they get on with the Sunni population of Australia?
Yes, we as a Shia really have no problem with the other groups, but we have been targeted, not just this time, through the history by the evil ideologies. Sunni also, not all of them are Wahhabis. Also, there is a Sunnis, fair people, and they have a peaceful ideology, and they follow Islam. There is Shia and Sunni friends, and there is no problem.
Thank you very much for being on the program.
You're welcome.
Akil al-Sharif, a spokesman for the Shiite community in Australia. Well, according to data on Australia's changing religious identity, just released from the 2006 census, many of Australia's bigger mainline Christian churches are continuing to decline. Buddhism, Hinduism and Islam continue to rise. The number of Hindus in Australia has doubled in the last 10 years to 148,000, and around 418,000 Australians now describe themselves as Buddhists, up from 200,000 just 10 years ago. And of course, Pentecostalism is surging ahead off a small base. There are now around 219,000 Pentecostals in Australia, compared with 175,000 in 1996. Professor Gary Baumer from Monash University analysed the figures for John Cleary's program on ABC Local Radio.
The census does not tell us what's going on inside local churches, synagogues, temples, mosques, ashrams, and other places of worship in Australia. It does say what Australians say about themselves in terms of their religious identification. That's been interesting. The nuns who went backward, that's the people saying no religion, went backwards in the last census 1 percentage point. That was quite striking. They've come back and have gone up to 18.5% to be joined by the falling Anglicans, who are now down to 18.5%. Quite a fall. Remember, in 1947, they were worth 40% of the population, less than half of that now. But continuous decline in the mainline Protestant groups, the Uniting Church falling to 5.7% of the population, nearly 10% drop, Presbyterians falling 6.4% down to 3% of the population. And the population, by the way, grew by 5.8%. So if you're not growing at 5.8% or more, you're going backwards. The Catholics had a slight decline, but very stable, and they have an age distribution that is pretty much like the national population. Pentecostals and others, and other Christians, that's a category, are really the growing edge of Christianity. They both grew at about 12% over the five-year period. They are the place where there is ample evidence of growth in identification. And because they're new groups, they have very few who are simply census Pentecostals, take Pentecostal and not go to church. So the percentage actually going is much higher. I estimate that about 5% of those who say they are Anglicans in Melbourne actually show up in church. The Baptists grew a bit. They're now up to 1.6%. Buddhists grew. They're now over 2%, 2.1%. Muslims grew. Hindus, Jews as well. Such that in Sydney, Buddhists and Muslims are both, or each rather, greater than the Uniting or Presbyterian presence. And in Melbourne, Buddhists and Muslims are greater than the Presbyterian presence. I think that's a very important thing to know. In those places, these groups are about 3% each, a little bit more. They're substantial, well-established religious communities. These are all consolidation of trends we knew about. But there's a terrible problem of age for the main line. And the main line churches like the Anglicans, the Uniting, and Presbyterians continue to age dramatically, such that for the Anglicans and Uniting, it's about 21-22%, which are 65 years old and older. For the national population, that figure is 13%, but for the Pentecostals, it's 7%, for Muslims, 3%, and for those with no religion, it's 8%. Now, with an age structure like that, you have a very serious problem, and are, at least demographically, are in very, very poor shape.
Professor Gary Baumer speaking to John Cleary on Sunday night. They also took talkback calls, including this very interesting one about the Sydney Anglicans.
Let's go to Roger in Maryland. Hello, Roger. Welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
I was just wondering, I'm a Sydney Anglican, and hearing tonight a lot of criticism of intellectual-based Christianity or intellectually-based mainstream religions. And I'm just wondering, Sydney Anglicanism seems to be a fairly downplay the spiritual experience and a fairly intellectual faith. I'm just wondering how your panelists would answer the fact that, or explain the fact that comparatively we're doing okay as a mainstream group.
I can answer that. Comparatively, you're not doing okay. Melbourne Anglicans, who are different to Sydney Anglicans, I'm a Melbourne Anglican, declined by 9.1%, whereas in the same period of time, Sydney Anglicans declined by 10.5%. But to your question, Sydney Anglicans have taken a very conservative, Calvinist, well theologically developed position on many issues and have claimed that that kind of firm and stern Christianity will open up new growth. I think that has yet to be tested in time. Where there does seem to be growth is where there is much more of a charismatic, almost Pentecostal kind of approach, or where that kind of conservative Christianity also has a very warm and accepting heart.
Professor Gary Baumer speaking to John Cleary on his program on National Local Radio on Sunday night. And now I'm joined in the studio by John Cleary. G'day, John. Let's just go through some of the things that we haven't sort of covered in the figures here. The Sydney Anglicans, it seems to me, the more we go through these figures, the Sydney Anglicans have got a bit to be upset about, don't they?
Well, I think they've got some concerns about their strategy. They did set the ideal when Reverend Dr. Peter Jensen became Archbishop of wanting 10% of the population in church, you know, by a certain date. And I think figures like this give them some pause for analysis about where they're going, and particularly young, the cohort that they're looking at is the young people, you know, from 15 on up to about 35, 45.
It's declining in the very areas where you would expect them to be strongest.
Yes, although there's a broad argument here that needs to take place about what the census actually tells us. That is, does the census tell us what people are doing in terms of religious practice, or does it really tell us how they generally identify themselves? And I think the Sydney Anglicans and others would be more interested if there were some tighter figures on religious practice, because the two figures could be going in different directions, you know.
As people's sense of cultural identification is declining, you're arguing that maybe what's hidden in here is that the small groups that you might expect to be declining are actually not declining as fast as you would expect, because
yes,
they're holding
because
on to
what
people.
That's right. What you may be in fact getting in the census is, yes, cultural identification is declining, but those who are hanging on to religion are hanging on more tenaciously. And if that's the case, what you'd expect to see is the broad denominations like the Catholics, Unitings and Anglicans declining, because they're coming off a very high base.
And that's what we see.
And that's what we see. And the smaller denominations either not declining, growing slightly, or holding on and just diminishing very slightly over time. And that seems to be happening as well.
The Baptists are slightly up.
Those denominations requiring commitment, you know, you've got to say, yes, I am one of these and I go every Sunday. Those denominations tend to be hanging on. So what you may be seeing is not, in fact, a decline in religion, just a more honest identification with who you are and what you believe.
Just to go back to the Sydney Anglicans for a minute, somebody put it to me that one of the problems that Peter Jensen faces with his 10% project is that it's a bit like a swimmer ploughing down the Olympic swimming pool, chasing the red line. What's moving ahead and ahead at a faster and faster rate is overall population growth in Sydney, and the Sydney Anglicans, try as they might, just can't keep up with that.
And it applies to a number of denominations with the population growth problem. If, say, you've got population growth at around 3 or 4%, so every denomination has to be increasing by at least that to stay where they are, and that's clearly not happening, except with one or two notable categories.
One being the Pentecostals, who are surging ahead. The Pentecostals, we often hear, have a very high churn factor. People are leaving out the back door as fast as they're coming in the front door.
Yes.
But we seem to have identified, I think, that the Pentecostals are up and are holding up right across the age groups. In other words, there are very healthy numbers for quite elderly Pentecostals now.
Yes, the growth is substantial and significant. Mind you, they're coming off a very low base. But what you're seeing is those people who've been saying, oh, yes, but you get a lot of churn through. People will stay for 5 years and then move on or
move
out. And
that this is only a religion that attracts the young.
Yes, that does not seem to be the case. Now, who knows what will happen over 15 or 20 years here, but certainly over the 10-year period that you can look from, say, 1996 to 2006, it appears that they're sort of holding and consolidating as well as growing.
And you've got an interesting theory about another factor here, and that is that they're attracting people of middle 40s, that sort of age group.
That group seems to be consolidating. What you've got there is people who are coming out of many of those groups that have a vaguely evangelical history to their background, but those denominations have lost their evangelical fire. You think of groups like the old Methodists, who were sort of the heart of the evangelical revival there in the Uniting Church. Now, the Uniting Church numbers are declining. Many of those may be shifting over to the Pentecostals. Similarly, I think there's a drift from the Salvos over to the Pentecostals, because the Salvos had that similar strong emotional connection, but it was also anchored to pretty stern discipline about serving the poor, etc.
And these figures suggest that changeover factor isn't just affecting the young, it seems to be happening in mature adulthood.
Yes, you're getting people in their 40s that are just shifting over, saying, I've had enough of this, I'm going somewhere else.
Gary Bowman's got a great line about this, hasn't he?
Yes, I think his line was, it's hard to find a breeding pair of Presbyterians.
It's great to have you on the program.
Thanks, Stephen.
And on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, online and on your pod, this is the Religion Report. Who is my neighbour, Jesus is asked in the Gospel of Luke. And to answer the question, he tells the famous parable of the Good Samaritan. A man is robbed and left to die in the street. A priest comes by and ignores him, then a Levite. And finally, a Samaritan comes along. And despite the mutual antipathy between Jews and Samaritans, the Samaritan takes the man to an inn to recover. Well, that Samaritan's descendants, good and bad, still live today in Israel and Palestine. There are less than 1,000 Samaritans left, making them the smallest religious sect in the region. Like the Jews, they venerate the five books of Moses, but their worship has features from Judaism and Islam. They sacrifice sheep, and some of their priests are fortune tellers and healers. Iris Mackler reports from Nablus on the West Bank.
Samaritans worshipping on Mount Gerizim, their holy mountain near Nablus in the West Bank. They believe that on this mountain, God created Adam, Noah landed his ark, and Abraham sacrificed Isaac. They call this a synagogue, but it looks more like a mosque. It's one large room with no furniture and carpets on the floor. There are only men praying here, no women. The men wear long white robes and have red fezes on their heads. They sometimes put their foreheads to the ground, just like Muslims at prayer. On the other hand, this service is taking place on a Saturday, the day which is holy for Samaritans, as it is for Jews. The priest is reading from the Torah, the five books of Moses, which is also the Jewish sacred text, and they're praying in the ancient Hebrew language of Aramaic. Kamal Ahed is the Samaritan priest.
Our great grandfathers and ancestors go back to Ibrahim, Ishaq, and Yaqub. Yaqub had 12 sons, and then Levi was one of these sons, from whom the Samaritans all descended.
The priest says that although Samaritans share ancestry and heritage with Jews, they diverged from them long before the time of Jesus. By then there was animosity between the two groups, which Jesus refers to in the parable of the Good Samaritan. Priest Ahed argues that Samaritan beliefs are more authentic. They only venerate the five books of Moses and still carry out animal sacrifices as commanded there.
I believe in everything that was delivered in the Torah. I don't believe in anything that the Jews added or changed. I believe in the original. Secondly, I do not believe in the sacredness of Jerusalem. I only believe in the sacredness of Mount Gerizim.
These days, Samaritans are also caught between Jews and Muslims politically. For generations, they lived peacefully in the Palestinian city of Nablus, close to Mount Gerizim. Then in 1967, Israel captured the West Bank, including this area. The Samaritans could speak both Hebrew and Arabic, and they acted as go-betweens in commercial transactions. Many became financially successful. But in the 1980s, during the Palestinian uprising known as the First Intifada, some Samaritans in Nablus were attacked. Peleg Altiev is secretary of the Samaritan community.
Some houses was burned by some unhumanitarian peoples from Nablus, of course. So all the Samaritans left Nablus and they lived here to be safe, yes.
Here was to their holy mountain, 10 minutes outside of Nablus. Some 400 Samaritans live here, with around 350 more in the nearby Israeli town of Holon. This may seem a tiny number to outsiders, but to Peleg Altiev it's progress. He remembers when there are only half as many Samaritans here. But he admits they do have one problem, not enough women.
The number of the girls are less than the number of the boys. So we try to find the girls outside of the community, especially from the Jewish community, because they believe with our Torah.
Once the Sabbath is over, with its strict injunctions against travel and work, the Samaritan priest can go back to his day job, and that's being a fortune teller. Ahed has an office in downtown Nablus, opposite a garage. There's no white robe or red fez in sight. In fact, today the priest looks more like an insurance salesman. But the Samaritans, like the gypsies in Europe, are a small group of outsiders who've become famous for their magic and spiritualism. And the priest's clients include Muslims, Christians and Jews. The priest reads a blessing in Aramaic for his first client of the day. He consults Samaritan holy books and does astronomical calculations. He says he doesn't censor his predictions, telling people everything he sees, both good and bad. He insists that this is not mere superstition, but is linked to religion.
I am connected to religion because I only do things that bring luck and good omen to people. I connect people. I bring people together. I am not a person to use my powers for bad deeds. I refuse to do anything against my religion. I've been given huge amounts of money in order to do bad deeds to people, but I refuse constantly.
Ahed goes through his files, preparing for the day ahead. Some clients want their fortunes told. Others need him to recover money that's been stolen. But most need help with family problems, such as infertility, or what to do if your husband has taken a second wife, or if any member of your family has been taken over by an evil spirit known as a jinn. This is the problem facing Abu Hikmet, a Palestinian gardener from East Jerusalem. He believes his wife has been possessed by a jinn.
When she talks, it is their voices that come out. Sometimes an older person, sometimes a younger person. My wife starts making sounds like a horse's sound. My wife starts having headaches and gets really disturbed. The jinn has taken over different parts of her body. She feels them. One is on her breast, one is on her abdomen, one is on her leg.
Palestinians believe that these evil spirits are conjured up by a priest who has power over them. Abu Hikmet says that the jinns have possessed his wife as a result of a curse placed on her by a family from their village. He says he has no other enemies, so he knows exactly who it is. It began because a boy from the village fell in love with Abu Hikmet's daughter. When Abu Hikmet and his wife refused to allow her to marry him, the boy's family cast this spell. Or that's how Abu Hikmet sees it. Since his wife has been possessed, she has headaches and is very stressed. But he says there's no point in going to a doctor.
I did not consider taking her to the doctor because I don't think she is sick. She is not sick with a normal disease.
Does his wife actually know? Does she understand this process herself?
Of course she knows, because she starts screaming when she's not screaming. She starts crying when she's actually not crying. Okay. They scream and they cry.
Abu Hikmet believes that his wife needs a different type of treatment. Treatment that only an expert like the Samaritan priest, or perhaps a specially trained Muslim sheikh, can provide. Priest Ahed says that fighting black magic is the most demanding part of his work. His weapon of choice is an amulet, in which he places protective words from the Bible.
I had a case where a young child, a girl, was taken over by a jinni. And she was talking to this jinni all the time. and she had no contact whatsoever with reality. I made a special amulet for her, a hijab called Al-Hijab al-Yusufi from Yusuf. It is related to Prophet Joseph. And she managed through this hijab, through this amulet, to get out of her disaster.
The priest says that removing curses is one of his biggest earners, but that business is down since the second intifada began 7 years ago. A campaign of Palestinian suicide bombings led Israel to increase the number of roadblocks and checkpoints across the West Bank. It's now impossible to enter or leave the city of Nablus without going through a checkpoint manned by Israeli soldiers. On the day I come to see the priest, the main Nablus checkpoint is closed. The Israeli troops say they've located a bomb placed by a Palestinian militant, and no one can enter or leave until it's been detonated. After the soldiers detonate the bomb, the ninth here so far this year, they reopen the checkpoint, and hundreds of Palestinians try to cross at once. Such restrictions on movement and travel make it difficult for his Palestinian clients to reach the Samaritan priest. And under Israeli law, his Jewish clients are forbidden from entering Nablus. So the priest sometimes goes down to the main Nablus checkpoint to deliver his amulets. That's what he did for Malaika, a Palestinian woman who drove all the way up from Jerusalem to seek his help. Malaika has a delicate family problem. Her daughter Amina is in her 30s and is still not married.
In our society, if a woman gets older than my daughter now, she will have to accept an older guy or a married guy. I didn't want this to happen to her. I wanted to see her chance now. I wanted to help her chances now. Additionally, Amina had many people propose to her, many good guys, educated and perfect, and she rejected them. What is the reason for this? I wanted to find out.
The priest says he cannot detect a curse or a spell, although perhaps Amina would cast one on her mother if she knew what she was up to.
Does Amina know?
Amina, no.
If Amina were to find out, she would slaughter me.
Priest Ahad charged Malaika hundreds of dollars for these treatments. But after 5 months, there's been no change. Amina remains willfully single. Malaika says she's lost faith in the Samaritan priest, even though she couldn't carry out all his instructions without alerting her daughter.
He gave me amulets to put in her shower, in her bath. He gave me amulets to soak in her drink. Some things I was able to do without her knowing. And some things I couldn't do. And some things I am not convinced about doing.
So maybe that's why it doesn't work.
The priest can't give us a clear explanation as to why Amina isn't married yet. As for Abu Hikmet, in the end he decided that the best person to rid his wife of her demons was not a Samaritan, but a Muslim sheikh, because the jinns fled whenever his wife read the Quran. Abu Hikmet has found a local sheikh who charges less than the Samaritan priest and does house calls. He's promised him his wife will be cured in 3 months. In this superstitious society, it's often men of religion who are the specialists in witchcraft. And this fight between the forces of good and evil appears to continue in a separate channel from the political problems Palestinians face every day. These are older beliefs that predate the conflict with Israel. They've always prevailed here, and perhaps they always will, whether you turn to a Samaritan priest or a Muslim sheikh or a Jewish rabbi to enlist the forces of good on your behalf.
Here is Makla reporting from the Holy Land, where they're still driving out evil spirits, just like in the Gospels. Well, that's all this week. Thanks to John Diamond and Noel Debien. You can get a transcript of this program on our website at abc.net.au/religion. Goodbye till next week from Stephen Crittenden.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.